Dr. Susan Smith, who is an Associate Professor of Safety and Health Education at Indiana School of Public Health, Bloomington, the University of Indiana. She has over 20 years of teaching and research experience related to injury prevention and emergency management. And I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to let her give her talk.
But it's on the system already, so you can punch the button and print it out yourself for people who don't want to haul it around a lot. And we're going to talk about that at the end of this presentation. And I'm trying something a little different in that I'm really going to be talking about going over the headings on each slide, but I've put the more complex material up on the web so people can follow up and go over it, since APHA things, in my experience, are kind of like advertisements, and you only get 15 minutes. And if you'll jump up and down when I have 2 minutes left, I would greatly appreciate it. Before I start, I'd like to say the last time I was presenting on this topic in Boston was in 1997, and I was presenting a school crisis and preparedness material from 100% of the school districts in Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Indiana, and a sample of school districts in Illinois, since they have a zillion. They have more school districts in the world. And that was in 1997, and I was presenting in the morning and the day before Columbine happened. So, you know, it's been a long time, but we're still addressing a lot of the same issues. And in that particular sample, in addition to flooding, we ask specifically about guns on campus. And you may want to add that to your survey, because that's a little different than are people shooting off guns. I mean, you might have an elementary kid who has a, you know, they came to school with a gun in their backpack, which happened when my kid was little, because they weren't too keen on what somebody said to them. But it never got shut off. It just got found. So that having guns available and having them brought on campus is sort of the near event situation or the near miss. And sometimes that's even more scary, especially in the South where you got guns everywhere, sad to say. My other announcement is I'm the associate editor of the International Journal of Emergency Management. In about a month, I'm going to be the editor. I would love to see those of you who are presenting write articles and submit them to the journal, which is online. I mean, you submit online. And also, if anybody would like to be a reviewer, I'm always looking for good reviewers, and boy, you find out everything anybody wrote around the world really quick when you start evaluating and reviewing articles. So if anybody's interested, please just give me a card and let me know. Now, like I said, I'm going to mainly talk about the headings, because I really put a lot of material in here to leave on the web. And in general, our schools are safe, and so administrators at schools really need to get that across to parents and children and faculty, so they're not in like an anxiety situation. And yet there are some real good steps that administrators and students and faculty can do to reinforce school safety and crisis response. And before I get into that, I'm giving a plug for this particular session. If anybody's in a school system and they're not fully engaging school health educators in development of disaster preparedness, emergency crisis response, they should be. This is just a sample of some of the competencies for health educators. And as you can see, I've put the word obtain emergency preparedness and disaster in front of the competency, which is obtain related data about educational, social, and cultural environments, interpret concepts and purposes, analyze culture, design educational programs, carry out planned programs, develop program objectives, formulate modes of collaboration, select educational resources, and there are a bunch of others. Sophie has just developed a list of draft policies. Actually, they've been up there for about 6 months. Society for Public Health Education modified into looking at disaster preparedness and emergency response in collaboration with CDC. So if you go on their website, you'll see every one of the competencies of our health educators focused on what they can do for emergency preparedness. And a lot of school systems, health educators are not being involved directly in preparedness, maintaining, and training. So I just grabbed some of the competencies that are used for graduate-level health educators, but they are important and critical for everybody. So that's my other promotion, I guess. But it's really important to understand threat assessment and risk assessment, conduct school preparedness drills, and cite local data on the prevalence of natural disasters and school safety incidents data, rather than doing something that you saw on national television and you decide that's what's critical for your environment. And as an administrator with faculty, a formal review should be conducted of all the school's safety crisis and emergency response policies and procedures. It shouldn't be something that just, and it should be done at least once a year, shouldn't be just stuck up on the, you know, up on the shelf. And key elements are pre-planning, communication, education and awareness, and evaluation. And you'll see some of the elements that are included in that. And we're going to start with some behavioral issues, but then we'll go to structural. There need to be behavioral expectations school-wide. So it's important that students and faculty know what's expected, what's not okay, and what the consequences are, and what do you do with someone who isn't, you know, right on with what they should do. And my children actually went to school in Tennessee, in Maryville, Tennessee, and one of the things I was impressed with their elementary school was they had several elementary schools, but next to one was what was called the White House Project, and any child that was having difficulty, could be bullying, it could be an emotional issue, they got up the same bus as everybody else, but for X amount of time, they just detoured over to the White House and worked with special people that were working there until those people felt like they'd worked out their issues, and then they just phased right back into the regular school day. And it seemed to be very, very effective because they really weren't isolated in some big old way because you could spit from one building to the other, you know. But at the same time, they had special resources and additional help and maybe in very small groups or one-on-one help. So having that kind of resource so you can catch things in the very beginning is also part of behavioral expectations. How do you help children meet the behavioral expectations, not just tell them they didn't do it? Also to highlight violence prevention programs, and in that same survey we did in the Stone Age in 1997, the weirdest thing was more elementary school programs reported having violence prevention programs than middle schools or high schools, which I really thought was weird, having done a lot of research on adolescent health and safety risk. You know, not to have those in middle school when parents are already trashed, but other adults still have some reliability quotient, you know. So, I mean, to not have those for middle schoolers and early high schoolers seemed really bad to me. Also, schools have to review their communication systems. If there's an emergency, for example, if electricity's off, nobody's phone system's going to work because they're all on switchboards, and the switchboard's out because the switchboard is electric. There's almost no phones left that are what we call four-wired phones that work even if electricity's off. The same thing with the loudspeaker. And in some cases, like look at the Twin Towers, nobody's cell phones work because either everybody was on them or the towers were on the things that got blown up. So having some, if you're in a residential school situation, at least having people who are trained in shortwave radio and have one on campus so you can actually communicate. And if you're in a day situation, you've got to figure out what you're going to do. What are you doing if your communication is cut off? Also, increasing trust all over the school. And that means having a higher trust level in students. And I was talking to some people in my prior group who are working on big violence prevention programs in places like Chicago. And I just finished doing a paper for my dean, and it's not an area I'd worked in a long time. And he was actually going to the UAE in Dubai, where I've done some work because I have a lot of former students doing health education there. But he was talking to a thing sponsored by the police on how to reduce recidivism from school and violence and keeping kids in school. And I started going back through all the literature in the United States, and almost everything I found showed that the more kids were involved in sports or extracurricular activities in the eighth grade, if you could keep them positively involved through the 12th grade, their entire feeling of trust and loyalty to the school was increased. And if your kid is loyal to the school, they're going to report a problem. They're not loyal to the school, they're not. But it also showed that if you got had a big problem of some kind and you dropped out in 10th grade from sports and extracurricular activities, the probability is you weren't going to stay in that school or you were going to hang around with the wrong people or get in real trouble. So the ironic thing to me is even like they had training for coaches that showed 3 hours of training to focus the coaches on helping individuals improve their skills and feel good and not just on winning really supported that. The sad thing is, what are we cutting in schools? Funding for extracurricular activities And also, we know forever, like from when I started working in universities in 1980, the bigger the school, the higher the dropout rate. Because there are more choices, less choices of those things to do. You can be a little fly on the wall. You know, you're not a part of anything. So also encourage student responsibility. Make sure that students know what's got to happen and why. They actually know how kids get in the schools. And I used to be pretty good because I had a kid who forgot everything. I knew every window open in the elementary school and every janitor, so you could get in the afternoon. All right, so also promoting compliance and communication about a problem. And you can do it through suggestion boxes, you know, where you don't have to put somebody's name in it. Keep guns and weapons out of colleges and schools. And I'm about to the point of saying, just like they do at every courthouse, if that means you have a metal detector, I don't think that's a bad thing. Now, my daughter, who's 30, would have been highly offended if everybody went through her backpack every day or made her use a tacky clear one. She made that perfectly clear as an art person. But if everybody's thing just shoot through the eye thing, you know, it's not like all your stuff is taken out and sorted through in detail, and you do it at courthouses anyway, there may be a point in some areas that people may really just have to do that. Even at courthouses, sometimes they don't scan any of the packages that come in the back door. So, you know, it's all a matter of how you do it and what you do. But things that are culturally acceptable, and in my daughter's school, you know, making everybody use a clear backpack wouldn't have done it, or taking everything out of people's backpacks and challenging the ones you thought looked sleazy would have been bad, too. Connecting with community partners is critical and bringing those kids into schools. I mean, bringing the partners in. Does your fire department know how everything is laid out in case they need to come? Do they know where the fire alarms are? Do you work closely with the school system? Do you have a security person on your campus? I actually had the interesting experience of having a death threat towards me, which we're pretty sure was a former GTA who did not get renewed. And we had to go to the school and talk to the security officer because the person who might have been involved was from my community, and we didn't want my kid whacked on the way home from school. And it was kind of at least good to have somebody there to talk to and say, you know, you're going to have to ride the bus, or you're going to have to walk with a group of people just to get home. And it worked out, because after we sent the FBI out of their house, they quit doing, you know, raw meat and bullets, and then they just sent it trashy magazines to your house. The only problem being, when you have a teenage boy, you really don't want a lot of trashy magazines. You had to get to the mailbox first. All right, conduct preparedness training for everybody. And when you write a question about do you do drills, you have to make it real clear that is not a fire drill. And research shows that for like third and fourth graders, if you don't do it every 3 to 4 months, and forget TV, forget those stupid CDs the National Safety Council puts out. It used to be on their board. You have to have like a hairdryer blow it under the door, feel the heat, and help the children figure out an alternate way to get out. Now, and it only lasts 3 to 4 months. I don't think adults are any better. So you've got to do it once a quarter, once every 6 months. And when you provide training, then you need to have crisis training for what, if there's a lot of different kinds of crisis that may be psychological in nature. Emergency preparedness and evacuation, particularly sheltering in place, and how do you do a needs assessment and what should be done. Now, it's really critical. Usually when I have my students, and this about kills them, when they get through, they can do anything. They have to take on a facility and do a security, emergency, and safety plan for a facility. Most things, if you can evacuate well and you can shelter in place well, you got most things knocked. Not everything, but a lot of things. So you really have to look at evacuation and where are you going to go and what are you going to do and where are you going to stand out where you can get shot, what are you doing? Or you're going to have to look at sheltering in place and how do you have people do that. So there are a lot of things you've got to do when you evacuate. You've got to make sure you can get out. You've got to have a clear warning and detection system. And you've got to have a way to shut off things like sprinkler systems, what are you going to shoot with a chemical fire extinguisher and what are you not? You never shoot them at people because they can suffocate them because they cut off oxygen. So there are things you do and things you tell people not to do. But fire is really important and it's a critical risk in schools. And if you have a multi-level school, you need to look at people who have transportation limitations temporarily and permanently. My kid once had a broken bone in her foot. Boys were carrying her down all these steps to go out the back door because that's where her class was supposed to evacuate. She could have gone down the front without having to go down a single step. But that wasn't in the plan. There was no alternative plan for people who couldn't walk and were on crutches. But also, and it helps you protect you, get lawsuits if you can do this well. And this is something that's used in a lot of hospitals that we're also recommending for schools because it only takes one person to help somebody down, and you can get them through creepy little narrow staircases. Most staircases are not wide enough to have somebody on either side carrying you and, you know, pushing down the sidewalk. Also, everybody ought to have something called a fire warden kit, and it should be dispersed throughout the school. And what is it? It's a thing where you put at least two fire safety vests or glowing red vests. So if it's pitch dark, if it's smoky, if something else happens, people can see you. It's good to have two people on a team, one at the end, one at the beginning if you're trying to get people out. You want to have some flashlights. I recommend a rope so people can hold onto a knot and you're down on the floor and you can get them out if everybody holds on. But also you even have things like wire cutters. And the rest of it is what do you need? What do you need in your area you might need? There's no standard, but it's hospitals and schools and other facilities should have them. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the building. It's important to have a really positive, good environment that's not so locked down people feel like they're in jail. At the same time, you need to limit access to the building so you know who's coming and going. And you know how people are getting in and how they're getting out. And sometimes that's easier for an elementary school or high school than a 2 or 4 year college. Remember the junior college where the shooter was in Texas last year? You know, that campus was wide open. All these relatives were running around talking to the media while their children were still locked down, and there were no fences so the guy could get out and run into the houses next door. So it's much harder on a wide open campus. You need to monitor parking areas and road entrances, and it's really good to have some kind of fence or something there so that two things. You can tell who's coming in, but you can monitor people going out, like what if the shooter's driving out in a car. But also, if you want to let your students out and you're in elementary school, you've got to control the crazy parents. And one way to do that is to have some perimeter, and you have the parents got to stay at this point in the perimeter, and we're bringing the children out. And if you don't have any perimeter barriers, it's really hard to do that. Parents are going to go crazy and fly right in. Also, you have to have supervision in common areas, hallways, cafeterias, and playgrounds. If somebody wants to shoot somebody, library, cafeteria, they get a lot of shots in one pop if they're in areas like that. Also, partnerships can be really important in helping to supervise. Block parents, different kinds of police surveillance, having good surveillance around your school, good monitoring, and community watch programs. All those things can work together. And while they're shutting down schools in Chicago, which I think is awful, because a community-based school is going to have a lot less recidivism and awful problems, they're at least trying to set up some kind of safe walking zones to get kids to the next school. And having grown up where I could walk to school and be involved in everything, and since our car had rarely worked, it was a good thing, it's going to be much more difficult when people are further away. You want to have a security presence and monitor school desks. Most people do that now. You've got to go into the office and sign in. But what if you get to wander around? And when I was talking about metal detectors, one of my former police officers in my graduate class said, well, you got to watch where you put the thing, because if everybody's blobbed up there outside the door, that's a good place to shoot people. So you've got to get people into the building as you're putting them, you know, in big groups again, and so nothing's perfect. You want to install and use security systems, but you also want to be able to evaluate your school. It's a facility. And you can use the 10-point checklist, of which I just distributed 6. I apologize for not bringing more. And the checklist allows schools to evaluate their preparedness. The particular one I distributed, and it's on the web for you to print off. Now, the one on the web is in a PDF file because that's what they made me put it in. But my name and email is on the bottom of it. And if you email me, I'll send you a Word version so you can modify it for your own facility and add categories. But it's developed for like a maintenance person or a faculty or a teacher. Every 2 to 3 months, you should go through the school head to toe and look, or have somebody assigned per building. You're looking at audible and visual alarms. You're looking at all a variety of things, and I'll show you these are the categories, and that thing is how many pages, 12, 13, something like that. But what you're doing is you want to make sure everything works, And if it doesn't work, you sign the bottom of it, you write the date, and you hand it to a purchasing agent who has an expedited means of getting it ordered and put in. So it's not like, well, yeah, that's been broken for 6 years. And I'll tell you, universities are horrid at it. My mom's now 95. When she was 85, I was at University of Tennessee. We're doing a health education SOFI statewide meeting. It's before the days of Proximus. We got cords everywhere. We got Proxima cords. We've got slide cords in a big room, bigger than this, in a room with no windows, obviously, on the first floor of our building. And the people on campus had forgot to tell anybody they were cutting all the electricity off for 2 hours. So right halfway through the presentations, while my mom is sitting in the back of the room, all the lights go out. Guess what? Not one of the emergency lights worked in that room. So it was like absolutely pitch dark till we could get 150 people out of that room, get them into the hall, and over to the front of the building where, thank goodness, it was glass in front of the elevator and they could see what they were doing. But if our building had done that sort of a checklist, they would have known that all the lights were burnt out in those emergency lights. And a lot of places have emergency lights that are on batteries. They wear out all the time. So, in summary, make sure your facility always is ready and because you've used something like this checklist. And that was developed before 9/11 with the Tennessee School for the Deaf, which had 40 facilities and 100 acres of land. And it's been modified through the National Safety Council and a lot since then, but it pretty well covers schools. Now power plants, all kind of people are using it. Conduct pre-planning, hands-on training with collaborators. Communicate, maintain ongoing education and awareness, and evaluate. And what that means is if you're going to have a drill, always have external evaluators, and not just your collaborators, because what happens, even if it's a 10 hospitals and 8 schools and the police department, when you get all through, everybody decides you shouldn't say anything ugly because nobody may play next time. So you actually have to have separate evaluators that say, well, this needed to be done this way, this needs to be improved, that needs to go up, because internal people can't do it, because they have too much to lose with the people they're collaborating with. And believe it or not, regional exercises sometimes don't do that. And health departments, fire departments and police and hospitals are wimps. I mean, they'll just sit there like lumps and not say anything. So when you do it, just make sure you take time. You can get a lot of free labor from universities and two-year colleges that are willing to either be victims or to be evaluators for a program, too. Thanks.